This episode of Warp 5 is brought to you by Audible.com, offering more than 150,000 titles for iPhone, iPad and iPod, Android, Kindle, Windows Phone, plus Mac or PC. To get a free audiobook of your choice, visit audibletrial.com/trekfm.
Hi, I'm Anthony Montgomery, Ensign Travis Mayweather on Star Trek Enterprise, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Trip.
Ready when you are.
Prepare for warp.
Course laid in, sir. Request permission to get underway.
Let's go.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Warp 5, our dedicated Enterprise show. I'm Christopher Jones, and this week, as I promised on our last show, I believe I did anyway, I am going to complete the Earl Grey hat trick. I have with me today the third member of our TNG show, Earl Grey, Darren Moser. Darren, welcome to the NX-01.
Oh, thank you, Chris. It's been a long time since I've been back here, but I am glad to be back. I always enjoy talking about Enterprise, and I'm glad to help you get that matching Earl Grey set.
I think I get a t-shirt, or do I get one of those mugs that you guys have with the Earl Grey logo on it?
I don't know. I'm going to have to run that by my executive producer. He had to approve the logo going on those mugs. I'm not sure what he's going to say, but I think I can pull some strings for you.
Okay, I hope so. That would be great. Yeah, last time you were here on the show, I remember we talked about regeneration and the Borg, and you even named the episode A Little Less Wetsuit, A Little More Laser Pointer.
Yes, I'm hoping for some witty puns in this hour so I can name it again.
Very good. Well, we were talking about a topic for today, and you suggested that we talk about the very creepy but very good Enterprise episode from season 2, Dead Stop. And it's one of my favorite Enterprise episodes, and really, I would say one of my favorite Star Trek episodes. And so I thought that sounded like a great idea.
Yeah, it's definitely one of my favorites. When I kind of rediscovered Enterprise, going through it in Netflix and did a whole watch through, and it was great. It's like new Trek. Hey, this is great, because I had missed a lot in first run. And this episode just definitely stood out to me for many of the reasons that we'll discuss, none the least, which is, you know, it's continuity from the episode right before it, great special effects. A mystery plot. I'm always up for a Trek mystery, be it Clues or Dead Stop. And I was really glad that you picked this topic for us to talk about.
Right. Well, actually, you picked the topic.
Well, you agreed with my pick. Yes.
Well, let's talk about it a little bit. You're from TNG, and the first subject that I wanted to talk about, thinking about a heading for this subject, I thought about Samaritan Snare, which is, of course, the title of a TNG episode, but it's interesting in Enterprise how naive the crew can be at times. I think about in season 1 with Archer out there saying, "Hello, we're from Earth.
You know, here's our spatial coordinates." Our
that's right.
Oh, gosh. I'm really surprised I didn't bite them more, because that's really... I loved every person they would meet, especially the ones who were just like, we work in space. I tow garbage. And it's like, what do you want? I got to tow this garbage over to the sector. It's like, I'm not an explorer. I'm just moving from parsec to parsec. Like, just chill out, dude. You know, I don't want to make first contact. I don't want to share my database with you. Which, I mean, those databases, is it like all of Wikipedia, like on a flash drive? I mean, what exactly are they giving them? I mean, do they edit out some of the more violent parts of our past? I would hope so. But yeah, Archer definitely leads the naive captains, but he's the first captain. I mean, he's got to figure it out. And he does get some stiff doses of reality, especially in the episodes leading up to this, where, I mean, his ship, it is, you know, they are looking for things to make them go. His ship has been banged up, blown up. It's missing a chunk out of the, you know, the saucer section, and hey, guess what? When the titles end in the beginning of this episode, there's still a giant chunk missing, and mm-hmm. that's, you know, just such a wonderful piece to begin with.
Which is great, because on the commentary for this episode, which is on the Blu-rays, but was actually, I believe, back on the original sets, I think it was, it's with Mike Sussman and Phyllis Strong. They talk about how in Star Trek, typically the ship's damaged, but the next episode, it's fine again, which is what I call the Dukes of Hazzard effect, because...
that General Lee.
If you remember, yeah, the General Lee could just get the crap knocked out of it, and then they go to commercial, and when they come back, during that 60 seconds, Cooter had fixed the General Lee, and it looked just brand spanking new. And that often happens with the Enterprise, and I love the fact here that they decided to actually address that in a realistic way in Star Trek. But as we're talking about Archer being naive, I think that's something that at times Enterprise got away from, even in season one, because there was this mix of everything's new, this is a prequel, and here are familiar aliens that you know and love, and here's familiar technology that you know and love. And so here was a moment where they did get back to that naivety, and the idea of them coming across this station, this repair station, somewhere out there in space, they have no idea where it came from.
It's so good to be true. I mean, it's just, it's ridiculous.
Right.
I mean, it's
way too good to be true, and yet they go in, and they're happy to let this mysterious alien station repair their ship, and initially, I think, buy into the idea that for some reason they can just pull in here and get everything fixed for a very reasonable price and be on their way.
Yeah, the ship, or not the ship, the station, which is basically a character. I mean,
it is, yeah.
And it, you know, Egg was giving them the silent treatment for a good portion, you know, as they're playing. I mean, it doesn't respond to hails. It just, it, I mean, they almost would have, I think, turned away except for the aperture of the you know, the port side just started to reconfigure itself to fit the Enterprise. And I mean, let alone just the fact that the Enterprise can even dock with any other ship. I mean, there is no Federation. There is no universal docking latch system. So the fact that, you know, the Vulcan ships and the, you know, Tellarite ships and this ship can all dock is just, you know, very, very lucky. I mean, they're really fortunate for that.
Darren, I think, and you should know this as one of our TNG hosts, go back to the chase. Now, when they seeded the primordial oceans, so, and that's why there are so many similarities amongst humanoid races, they also put in there a predisposition toward universal docking ports. And also universal computer interfaces. That's why you can go on an alien ship and work the control panels with such ease. It's also why all ships from all races can easily dock with one another.
Well, I mean, it, to a point, it does make sense. A humanoid, I mean, if everyone is humanoid, their airlocks are going to be that kind of oval-ish, 2-meter-high shape. I mean, they're not going to be this weird hexagon, you know, Forbidden Planet triangle door. You know, it's that. So I get that part, but okay, we'll look past that onto the awesome space station. But
well, what did you think about the station itself? Now, they never explain, of course, in this episode or anywhere else on television in Star Trek, where the station comes from. And I kind of,
which is great.
It's great. Although it is something that I think that in a 7-season run of Enterprise, it would have been cool to come across another one somewhere and revisit that. And so there's been speculation amongst fans over the years about the origins of this station. One thing that I have heard before here and there is like maybe the Borg built it. I don't buy into that at all. For one thing, it's white. Yeah. I mean, the Borg, you know, they like gray.
They like their greens, they're like
black,
and blacks.
Greens, yeah.
Not nearly enough laser pointers, you know, built into that station. But
no.
Yeah, I could say the species that was maybe species one, could have built it, you know, that founded the Borg. I would buy
one.
That.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I'd buy that more than the Borg as we know them, because it just, why would they build this? It doesn't serve their purpose at all, or at least the way they operate is in any regard that we know of. But yeah, I love the station. It's the design is really nice. The way it reconfigures, you know, kind of that, I don't know, it's like that accordion, you know, kind of spherical, you know, or cylindrical design, and it's totally believable. That's the nice thing. I mean, they're presenting this new technology and this new station that we've never seen before, but you completely buy that some race could have built this. I mean, it's not too far beyond the realm of plausibility, and the way that our characters react to it, you know, as we go on, you have, you know, Reed and Trip, and they're like, wait, this thing is doing amazing things. Where the heck is the computer? I mean, it's our computer's three decks high, you know, and this, as far as I can tell, there's this tiny room in between them. So when they start to react to it like normal humans and going, wait, this isn't a TARDIS ship. You know, this isn't a TARDIS station. It's got to have a computer. And then obviously it drives the plot forward. But, but yeah, I'd say much more 2001 look than Borg.
Look and feel, yeah. But what you described there, I think, is probably why some people speculate that the Borg built the station, because it reconfigures itself. It can regenerate. It can repair ships. It's very much like a Borg-like technology.
It has a collective intelligence
there.
Hive mind. No, it does have a lot of similarities. I do buy that. I kind of like my species designation one theory a little more.
I like that, actually. I really like that, because it's like Iconians, or taking it outside of Star Trek, it's like the transport network in Contact, in Carl Sagan's Contact. You know, it's this,
or the ancients in Stargate, you know,
right?
We don't see them, but they've left stuff behind.
They left
that
stuff
we get
behind
to find.
Yeah, and I think that's really cool. And we don't get very much of that in Star Trek, only a little bit here and there. And I think it's a really cool idea that we should get more of. Now, here is something, and this is a spoiler alert. So if you're planning to read Christopher L. Bennett's Rise of the Federation book series, and you haven't yet read Tower of Babel, you may want to cover your ears for the next 15 seconds.
I mean, take out your earbuds, because if you cover your ears with your earbuds in, I tried, it doesn't work.
That's true. The final line in the book, in the second book, The Tower of Babel, is, "Your inquiry was not recognized."
Oh, that's chilling.
And then it says, "Star Trek Enterprise, Rise of the Federation will continue."
Oh man, that's giving me shivers up my spine right now. Yeah, that's
so okay. We're done with the spoiler part right here for a novel. And of course, I think most of our listeners don't read the Star Trek books anyway, so, but you should, because the Enterprise ones are very good.
Why read them when you can listen to them on audible.com?
I wish the Enterprise books were on Audible.
Oh, that's true.
We
that's
have true. To get Star Trek books back in audio format. But anyway, so that's really cool that we may, in the books, in the next entry in the Rise of the Federation series, find out the origin of these stations. Or we may not. It may remain a mystery, but it seems that one of them may appear there.
I mean, it's kind of like Trelane of TOS. I mean, there's so much speculation now that he was a Q, you know, but yet for 50 years, we didn't care. So it's fine if they add that in and put that piece of the puzzle in place. But if they don't, you know, we'll come up with our own awesome theories. You know, that's just what we do.
It's fun to fill in those blanks. Well, let's go on to the continuity elements, because that's another thing that I love about this episode. And you know, I'm a Niner. That's my favorite series is Deep Space Nine. And one thing I love about Deep Space Nine so much is the continuity of the show from episode to episode and just the serialized nature of that story. And Enterprise was sort of a hybrid for me between DS9 and the rest of Star Trek, closer to the rest of Star Trek, but it did have a little bit of DS9's serialization in it. And I'm not talking about the Zindi arc, which was specifically designed to be this long story, right. But I'm just talking about remembering that things happen in past episodes. And this episode, it combines a number of callbacks. There's the obvious one, which is that it picks up from Minefield, and we've got damage to the ship, which you already mentioned. Reed
is... It's like
is,
literally 3 days later or something, or maybe even a week. It's no time has passed at all.
It is basically, in Star Trek terms, again, outside of Deep Space Nine, it is basically a sequel to Minefield in terms of the events and what happened to the crew there. And besides that, Reed's leg is still injured. He's having to rehabilitate that. And then it also has nice little callbacks, like the fact that Trip scratched the ship in Broken Bow when they bumped into it with the shuttle pod.
That was a clever one. I like that.
Yeah, included. It was a really cool one. And they also have references to other things in Star Trek, like the Tarkalians from Trials and Tribulations are mentioned in Trials and Tribulations. And, you know, you hear about Tarkalian tea all the time, and it was great that they brought that in. There's a Cardassian in the server rack at the end of the episode when they actually go in there. You have to be looking closely. And one really clever one that I love is that inside Travis's quarters, Archer is in there at one point. And he gets the call on the intercom system. And in The Changeling, the original series episode, The Changeling, there's the Nomad space probe. Well, there's actually a model of the original Nomad probe in Travis's quarters before it actually became the kind of merged probe that we saw on TOS. So I love the continuity in here.
And that's one of the things that Enterprise really did well is, I mean, yes, it had its difficulty of how do I write as a prequel, you know, how do I, but again, it has this, still it has this rich history that it can draw on and it can tie in and, you know, some episodes it didn't do it as well, but this was one where it really excelled. You could tell the writers knew their stuff. They were, you know, they weren't living in that writing room the entire season. They were like, oh, we've actually watched Broken Bow recently. Hey, what if we put in, you know, that? Because again, this is the age, this is before Netflix, before you could, you know, I don't think these people were constantly combing through old episodes to find things. You kind of had to already know it and kind of have it, you know, in your Bible or in your notes. But yeah, I love the continuity. I love, just how, you know, but it's not a part two, you know, but like you said, if you watch these in the opposite order, it wouldn't make any sense. You'd be like, wait, why is the ship busted? And then it gets fixed. I mean, versus TNG where you can watch, you have seasonal or series changes. So if something happens, you could watch pretty much season two in almost any order and it wouldn't really matter. But you wouldn't want to go from like season three to season two that, you know, all of a sudden, or even two to one, then Geordi's now in red and what's going on. And so, I love that continuity aspect in this episode.
But at the same time with this episode, you could watch it without knowing anything about Minefield.
True.
And it still works perfectly fine.
You could skip Minefield and still watch it. Yeah. You just wouldn't want to watch Minefield after this.
Right. Yeah. Or if you did, you would say, oh, that's why the ship was damaged at the beginning of that episode. So the episodes stand on their own perfectly fine.
True.
But if you do watch them in order, you get that little bit of, you know, what people call a reward for being a viewer, I guess. You get a little extra for paying attention week after week.
And you know, I think the reason fans really like that, at least as a whole, is one, it's not treating them like they're dumb. I mean, it's like, hey, we know you watch the show. We know there's continuity. Let's try to put that in as much as we can. I mean, not take it to the extreme of like a Lost, where if you miss an episode, you're just lost. I mean, that's on one end of the spectrum. And then on the other, you have, you know, an Isle of Lucy show or something where like it there's no continuity at all. It's just complete episode based. So somewhere in the middle, I mean, you could have the spectrum from TOS to you know, DS9 being on the more serialized end. But yeah, I agree with you. I think Enterprise kind of is that nice middle hybrid, which I think also just comes from it's the latest of the series. Mm-hmm. And so that's just more the trend,
right?
You know, to write in larger arcs, and like you said, especially season 3.
Well, television has moved even further towards serialization kind of across the board since the time Enterprise was shot.
It has.
At the same time, I feel like Enterprise does fit in pretty well still with television. Like if you watch Enterprise right now for the very first time, I think it still feels like a new series to you. I don't think it feels very all that dated in terms of storytelling.
Well, part of it is it was shot in 16:9, so that helps. I mean,
yeah, the visuals,
every time,
yeah.
You know, I'm watching, well, not just the visuals, but just the aspect ratio. I mean, it doesn't look like a square. I mean, every time I'm watching, you know, I'm wishing for little extra edges on the sides of my screen. But.
Was that jarring to you? Did you watch Enterprise in its first run?
Yes, I did. At least the first season.
Okay. Yeah. Was that jarring to you to see Star Trek in that 16:9 ratio?
It was a little, because I was watching on 4:3 television. So,
okay. I
hadn't yet, you know, bought, because they were ridiculously expensive at the time. But
well, it
you
was
know,
not
so
common
it,
at that time to have a 16:9 television in your. I think it's great. They were very forward thinking about that. Mm-hmm. I think that they knew that's where things were headed.
Like, it's not going to go back.
Right. And likewise, they knew they had the foresight to know that things were headed towards HD. So they actually did the visual effects in HD, yeah. Even though they didn't have to at the time.
And that's why we got the Blu-ray so much sooner. I mean, right. It was much less of a deal to than TOS or Next Gen to recompile. Right.
Although I have to say, with Next Gen, those guys,
it's amazing.
They were very, very smart. It's like I'm sure they didn't anticipate that 25 years later, that everything was going to be in this HD, and you know, they're going to need all that. But they went ahead and they put all that extra work in, and they did all that detail work, and they shot it on film. And I know some of the visuals had to be redone, but for the most part, all that detail that we're seeing now was put in there with them not knowing that anyone would ever see it. It's amazing.
I mean, you could easily make the show going, well, this is going to be output at like 420 a line high. I mean, that's ridiculously small. That's not a good resolution at all. But it makes me, though, kind of sad just for current shows, because a lot of stuff is shot digitally now. And it's like, when you shoot digital, you're kind of locked in. I mean, you can up convert, but it's not the same as film. I mean, people don't realize, like, a single frame of film is just ridiculously dense and complex with an image. Like, you can, whatever 30 years from now technology of digital that would come out with, you could still probably go back to a 35 millimeter print and pull to that quality.
Oh yeah.
It's beautiful. So
watch the Twilight Zone.
Oh,
it looks beautiful in HD.
Well, and then just the black and white just looks beautiful.
Yeah.
Like, from the get go. But
So here with Enterprise, anyway, they were very smart in prepping the show for all of this, and it looks great. And so we were talking about continuity a little bit, and we love the continuity elements here. And the other thing about this episode that I love is that sense of unknown and how this episode does capture, and it kind of goes back to what I was talking about at the beginning with the naivety. But it's not just naivety, because you could also see you could see Picard's crew going to a station like this, and it being a complete mystery to them as well. Mm-hmm. I think that in Star Trek, through TNG, DS9, and Voyager, we kind of got that feeling that everything's familiar. Like, even if we haven't encountered this alien race before, there's really not very much about them that would be unusual to us.
I mean, especially in Voyager, I mean, they're supposedly halfway across the galaxy, and yet they encounter opposition X from species Y, and just, you know, they're going to get through it. You know, it's not going to be an issue. But with Enterprise, they've given enough resistance to the world that you're like, well, I don't know. Like, I don't think a main character is going to die, but it's, you know, something's going to happen and we might mm-hmm. lose a couple members or we might be in trouble.
And they find technologies that are unusual to them, which you kind of didn't see very much anymore. But again, this station could be something that, I mean, if Picard's crew encountered this particular space station, I think they would also be sort of, what's going on here? You know, I mean, maybe
there
Geordi
was technology to rival 24th century almost. I mean, it was pretty advanced.
Right. Well, and even some of the stuff that this station does, the Federation can't do even in the 24th century, the kind of reconfiguration mm-hmm. to adapt to whatever ship comes in and whatever the needs of it are. It's really quite amazing. So this did a really good job of capturing that sense of unknown here. How did you feel about that aspect of the story?
I really liked what they didn't say. I mean, like we said, just from the, even from the beginning when they're not getting response from the Hale and mm-hmm. when they do get on board, there's not some plucky Neelix character. I mean, nothing against Neelix, but just, you know, a character who's like, I'm full of answers. Ask me anything. You know, oh, this ship, it was built such and such. And oh, you're mm-hmm. you're my millionth customer. Ha ha. You know, it wasn't like that. It was this calculating, you know, Siri. It was mean-spirited Siri that was basically, you know, I'm not going to give you any answers that I don't have to. You know, you're going to pay me and I'm going to fix your ship, but I'm not going to tell you anything else. And you know, that maybe a Tellarite ship coming up would have no problem with that. But we're humans. We're curious. I mean, that's why we're out here. So everything about the situation, like, irks us, but like drives us to understand, like, okay, well, who built you? Well, who's running this? Well, you know, who do you report to? Like, what's going on? Like, where's my crewman? You know, when's my ship going to be done?
Mm-hmm.
And we just can't stop asking questions. And all we get is, you know, your inquiry is not recognized. That's like infuriating. So I love it's just like in horror when you don't show the monster.
Right,
because what your mind imagines in the shadows is 10 times more powerful. So you don't give all the answers of why this station's here, who built it, you know, what's it going to do, you know, because that puts you right next to Archer experiencing it with him because he doesn't know. I mean, yes, even if he has, you know, even if you're thinking, well, I'm sitting right next to Scott Bakula. I mean, even with the script that he has, he doesn't know. I mean, he doesn't know how this is going to end, and I love that mystery about this episode.
He had some nice touches in there too, like when they go up to the table that's the replicator, and T'Pol gets the glass of water, and Archer peeks under the table to find out. and that was not even in the script. That was just Scott Bakula improvising.
My favorite technology though had to be the replicating arm. That not the one on the outside, but the one inside that was like working its way through the corridor and would just like scan a component and then just like completely reconfigure a module and then plug it in and it's like done. And it's like, wow. That's again where Picard doesn't even have this technology. Like this technology is probably just getting installed on the Enterprise J.
Yeah.
You know, but
that's Borg like really cool technology, that regenerative technology.
Or just replicative. I mean, it was replicators to a much higher technological sophistication than, I mean, even the table. I mean, we've seen replicators. It's a box in the wall and it has to be in this space and you know, don't put your hand in there when it's being formed. I mean, there was no safety shield around that table when it formed something. You could have stuck your fingers half in the glass if you wanted to, but yeah, the table, the regenerative arm, you know, all those pieces were really cool. I think this episode was even nominated for like visual effects. It was done so well.
Yeah, it was, and it actually won an award for the models of the space station itself. Of course, they're digital models; they're not physical models. Right. But it won an award for that as well.
I'd give it an award.
Yeah, the technology in here is interesting because it does give us a glimpse of, like you say, Starfleet technology before it happened.
Right. Except we're familiar even with more advanced replicators and transporters and, you know, really smart AI computers. I mean, the computer in Enterprise doesn't talk to them, but we're used to that. And so it's, again, that hat nod to people who've been watching next gen set in the 24th century. It's like, oh, hey, look at this. Another species has this before we do.
Yeah. But when they pulled in, I wanted to hear the computer say, please state the nature of the structural emergency.
That would have been good. And they would be like, hey, that's catchy. We should write that down. But
there's also medical technology in here too, like medical regenerative technology. And do you see cloning technology in here in a sense? I mean, that's not a Starfleet technology per se. I mean, I guess Starfleet could, humans could clone, but they don't for ethical reasons in the 24th century. But we do see other alien races who clone.
I think so, to a point, although I would say it's less cloning and just replicating dead matter, because the clones are never alive. And it's just, again, it's the core of that replicating technology. It's like, well, we're just going to, instead of make a bulkhead, we're going to make the structure of a living organism, but it's not, it doesn't have that essence or life in it. So I wouldn't go so far as cloning, because that, I think, like, it's a very biological type process, whereas this is a very mechanical, biomechanical process. And then like Reed's leg getting healed by that prop, and that prop I wanted to touch on. I did eventually read that it was a reconstructed exocomp from Next Gen.
Yeah.
Just turned on its side. But it was funny is because again I was watching through, and I think it was only two episodes later I saw it sitting in the background of the shuttle bay, and I'm like, wait a minute. That is the leg healing medical device from the space station sitting next to a socket wrench by the shuttle. I caught you guys trying to hide little greebles in the background, but you know, I let it slide because the show had been off the air for 10 years. But.
And so this must be the precursor to Dr. Crusher's magic little laser healer.
Oh yeah, the dermal regenerator, or the little, you know, laser scalpel or inverse scalpel.
The dermal regenerator, yeah.
But and again, yeah, why wouldn't their medical technology be farther advanced than ours? But they definitely, I mean, I could see why the crew of the Enterprise would be interested in this technology. It's like, hey, you know, we don't have to go back to Jupiter Station every time, you know, we break something. How about we get, you know, you trade us one of those hydro spanners for, you know, some more warp plasma.
Mm-hmm. What did you think about the, well, we've talked a lot about the station itself, but the interface of it is something that I think we can all associate with, because it's almost like, for what you guys would be familiar with in the States, most of all, probably an ATM machine at a bank. And for me here in Japan, it's that and also the ticket machines at the train stations, which are similar type touch panels that are really complex with all sorts of options that you have to pick through. And sometimes you get very frustrated with it. You know, you're just like, I just want to talk to a person. But instead, it's here. And it also reminds me of how you can't talk to a human anymore. You know, it's always automated customer service from hell.
Yeah, I'd say it definitely reminds me when you're calling, you know, a company up and it's like, nope, you can't get to a person. You have to get through our five levels of, you know, software management. We're going to make it easy, though. You can just say yes or no. It's like, I don't want to say yes or no. I don't want to push one or two.
Did you ever do this? This was my technique with that when I lived in the States, and this was a good 10 years ago, so I'm sure the technology is better now than it was back then. If I ever got one of those things, I would just start yelling random things into the phone to overload it, because then it would kick you over to a human. It would give up and it would
kick
you over.
So you kirked it.
I kirked it
to death so it melted down and then gave you its human master operator. That's a great idea.
That's right.
I just kept hitting zero, saying zero's operator. If I keep hitting zero, they got to let me into a person. But
that's right.
I think there's actually websites out there where it's like called like Save You Time or something.
Oh, yeah. I've heard of that.
You can punch in.
They tell you
I need
what
to call Comcast. Well, if you want to get to this function, hit 1152. And it's like, okay, I can do that. But
that's the thing.
I can say yes or no, but I can't say Inglés, you know, instead of two for Spanish. But, you know, again, it's not that much better in 10 years. But no, this automated voice.
It was so effective. And it's Roxanne Dawson. And of course, she directed the episode. They actually, I didn't know this until after I had been on, and they talk about it in the commentary, but they actually auditioned a number of different people for that voice. You know, at first I kind of assumed, well, Roxanne did it because she's directing the episode. She has a great voice for it. So why not? And of course, they do mention she was willing to do it for free. So that's a bonus.
That's always helpful
in production. But I can't think of anyone better for it. I mean, unless they maybe had Marina Surtees do it.
True. But I don't know. Hasn't she? She has done the voice in some other instances. Mm-hmm. Maybe not in Enterprise.
Well, she does the voice in Star Trek Continues, I believe.
That's right. That's where I've heard it. Yeah. Well, it reminded me a lot of, you know, that story of Roxanne Dawson doing it, of Han Solo. I mean, Han Solo was Harrison Ford reading lines versus other people, and he just became Han Solo because he's been reading the lines the whole time. And same thing, I could totally picture Roxanne delivering the lines like, okay, say it like this. You know, your inquiry is not recognized. And then they would say, and she's like, no, not quite right. You know, and then realizing, okay, I'm just going to do it because I've now realized I am the perfect person. Or, you know, Brad Bird, who directed The Incredibles, who voiced Edna Mode, because he was the only one who, I mean, they couldn't do better than his voice, as strange as that sounds. But yeah, I was going to say, you know, that this, you know, voice, it was really bossy. And, you know, I felt it had a troubled childhood of being an alien, but it didn't, and it took it out on the Enterprise. It was really upset. You just don't want to bring up its past, or call it Turtlehead, but, no, it was a great, great part of the episode.
It's interesting to me because I'm so accustomed in Japan to having things talk to me, you know, the ticket machines. I mean, our bathtub tells us when the bath is ready at night.
A little creepy, I'm not going to lie. But
the bath, well, we'll see. I mean, you want your downstairs, right? But your bath is filling upstairs and it's all automated.
Oh,
like,
okay.
We don't turn on faucets to fill the bathtub in Japan. You press a button on a control panel and it's all automated and the temperature is all controlled as well. And then it fills up and it lets you know when it's ready and you're downstairs, and so you need to know, and so the panel downstairs actually makes announcements to you. And so I'm really accustomed
to that.
Or trains or ticket machines or buses or whatever talking to me in this, and it's usually a female voice, and it's kind of like this. It's very polite, but it's also not very emotional either. It's kind of, in the case of things here in Japan, I don't want to use the word uncaring, but in the case of the space station, I do kind of think of it as polite yet uncaring. It's just, it's here to give you information and it's going to do it very nicely, but don't ask it for anything special.
When you ask an inquiry, it is activating its vocal processors for the exact millisecond amount of time to respond and then it's done. Mm-hmm. It doesn't care if you, it doesn't small talk. It's not, it didn't subscribe to Hutch Hutchinson's, you know, school of small talk for AI computers and androids, but it adds to that mystery because it's not giving you any answers. And, you know, I'm already suspicious because that, you know, that little robot in the middle looks mighty familiar. Which I think was a prop reuse from Think Tank in Voyager, that little sphere
with
LEDs going around it. And I'm like, okay, this thing's evil because you don't use that in a central core of something nice. That is not art. It is watching you.
Maybe the station is collecting props from other episodes of Star Trek. The station actually goes around. It's a collector. It's a Star Trek.
It moves through time and space, and it gathered an exocomp from that episode and the AI from that episode. And it may be Fajo's race from from the most toys. Maybe he built this, although I highly doubt that they would be technologically advanced.
I doubt it. If he built it, it would be really, really gaudy. It wouldn't be nice and white and clean like this.
Maybe this was their minimalist era.
But the voice was the perfect thing for Archer to play against, because we talk about human naivety, the sense of the unknown, how do humans react to things, and Archer is a lot more like Kirk in this type of situation, but
he wants
maybe
to talk
even
to a person.
Well, he wants to talk to a person, but like I think Kirk would get upset at it and want a solution more quickly than Archer does. Archer is gonna like, oh wow, this is kind of cool. Oh, they're gonna do this for us. And wait a minute, you're not listening to me. And finally, he gets really ticked, and he's, you know, you. There's that great shot of what Archer looks like from inside the control panel.
Yeah.
Whereas I can see Picard, like Picard would eventually just kind of sigh and tug on his tunic,
and then ask Data and Geordi to figure it out.
Right, and that would be it, you know. So Archer gets very frustrated, but it is the human nature, right? Like at a point we're going to get so frustrated with this. And then, as you mentioned earlier on in our discussion, then we really try to figure out just what's going on here. And that's where they really do figure out what's going on. And of course, the fact that the station thinks that Porthos is a crew member was a wonderful little use of Porthos in this episode. And there's a great, I love the shot of Porthos in his quarters with Archer, but the perspective is like they're shooting it from Porthos's level. They're down
really,
on the
really
floor.
Low.
Yeah. It was beautiful camera work there.
I'm sure they had to, you know, drill a hole in the floor and shove a giant HD camera into it, but it was worth it. It yeah. gave that unique perspective, and but again with the mystery part as the episode progresses and we lose a series crew member, like, oh my goodness, like that, wait, this is episode what, 4 or 5 of season 2? That can't happen. I mean, I know he's born in space, and I know a lot of people feel he's already, you know, run his course on where his character's going, but you can't just kill, you know, Mayweather, you know, who's going to fly the ship? And you know, that was some nice twist. I again, it was another great episode because everyone kind of did something.
Yeah.
You know, or figured out a piece of the puzzle as it went. You know, T'Pol was always distrusting, and, you know, Archer was like, I'm going to have a plan, and Porthos was like, you look funny, and, you know, everyone did something.
And Trip was like, I'm going to have some pan-fried catfish.
This is the best ever. It's like, Captain, before we blow it up, can I just have it replicate pan after pan after pan of pan-fried catfish and just shove it in my locker? No, Trip.
Talking about the replicator technology being more advanced, though, apparently, it's predictive, I guess. I was going to say adaptive, but maybe predictive. You say pan-fried catfish, it prepares the rest of the meal for you, because it was like a full meal.
Yeah,
they didn't ask for
everything that would go with it,
right?
You know, with appropriate wine on the side, almost.
Right, exactly.
I mean, if you drink wine with catfish, I don't even know, but
probably not. I think you drink beer. I'm from Alabama. We do have catfish. You can go to the catfish restaurants dedicated to nothing but catfish. I'm pretty sure beer would be the choice of drink.
Yeah, but exactly. It was the full meal. I mean, this isn't shake and bake. It gives you, you know, everything.
But talking about Travis, I thought it was really clever, though, because Travis didn't have that much to do on the show. Now, when I go back and watch season 1, I do see a lot more for Travis in those episodes than I remember them being. So I think that the notion that Travis is a forgotten character right off the bat is something that's sort of it's a collective,
it's a reflective.
Yeah, it's a
notion.
It's sort of like the common belief that has evolved over time. It's not completely accurate as to what's on the screen. However, he is probably, maybe he and Hoshi are the least used characters on the show. And so if you are going to pick a character who's going to die in the episode, Travis was a really good choice to kind of make the viewer think for a moment that maybe he did die. Kind of like
and you had continuity from the last episode. So maybe in the next episode, he's still dead. I mean, maybe he'll come back later. Who knows? I mean, yeah, he does feel like that fifth character, like, you know, he's that far removed from the main person that you're like, okay, maybe something is going to happen. You know, maybe he felt he wasn't getting enough screen time and he wanted to leave the show. I mean, they're just like, yar, you know.
Yeah. You never know. I mean, I think, again, watching it as a Star Trek fan, you're thinking, okay, he's not dead. They're not going to kill the main character, but...
My Netflix queue says I still got a couple more seasons left. So I know he's not dead.
But if it had been Reed or Tripp or T'Pol who they had found, then you would know something's up right off the bat.
Yeah, it's true. Yeah. It would have tipped their hand way too early in the episode.
There actually was, they were going to have a scene in the episode where Travis actually saw his doppelganger, saw his replicated clone. Mm. We decided we weren't really going to call this cloning, but they decided not to do that because they did feel like that
his kinda, copy
that tipped the hand too soon.
Right.
Yeah. If that were the case.
You see it beam in and then the, you know, paralyzed, you know, Travis gets beamed out or something like that.
Right. One thing that I didn't actually put on the outline, but one thing that I do really enjoy about this episode as well is the character moments that we get. Because again, one reason why I love Deep Space Nine is because of the really, really deep character interaction. And this episode does a really good job of that as well. We have moments between Archer and Reed. We have a great scene between Hoshi and Phlox, which I think they both play really, really well. And John Billingsley in particular plays that scene beautifully. He is so good at playing those emotional moments.
Yeah, no, he's almost the hidden gem in the cast because he's just really, really good actor, and he gets a lot of great episodes and a lot of great lines. Fortunately, like, they use him, and he's not, you know, underserved. But yeah, and that scene with Hoshi, I mean, it's nice because it makes me think of like Q-Who. And you have a portion of the Enterprise gets sliced off and you know 27 or so crew members have died. And we see Picard, he's like mad about it, but we don't, I mean, it's a crew of 1,000. So it's kind of different. Whereas, you know, that, you know, even one person dying on the NX-01 is a huge deal. And we're like, as humans, we want that to be felt. It's like, okay, this should be a big deal, you know, especially for those closest to him.
Yeah, absolutely, because they are a tight-knit family there. And I just think it's... I think that is an overlooked element of this episode because it's so much of the focus is on the station and is on the creepiness of the episode and kind of the horror feel to it. And yet it does have some of the best character moments in it.
No, it's a very strong installment for season two by far. It sets a very high bar to match.
Oh, most definitely. Well, is there anything else about this episode that you love about it that we haven't covered yet? Any final thoughts you have on it?
I definitely have to say the end shot. I love the end shot where they've battled off the robotic arms and they've blown up the warp plasma and warped out, you know, mostly fixed up. I mean, which is fortunate that they didn't discover, you know, all this bad stuff when they were still in a wreck. But at the very last shot you see is one of those arms and it grabs a piece of the floating station and holds it next to its adjoining slot and kind of starts to repair it. And it's just, and the ominous music plays and you're like, oh, it's putting itself back together. You know, in a couple of months, it could just be sitting there like normal, like nothing had happened, ready to... I mean, I'm sure it probably lost its main core, but it would start again at square one. And then the first ship, it's its first donation to its computer core. And just that scene, just that hint of this isn't over was great. I love that part of the ending because it just... Because we still didn't know who these people were. We still didn't know who built it, whether it would show up again. And I mean, I didn't really expect it to show up again because they're not traveling in that direction. But I love that. I think that was the perfect ending to the episode.
Yeah, it was. That's why if there were 7 seasons, I would hope that we would encounter one of these stations again, because it is creepy and it's there in the musical cue and everything. It's great. And that's why I love what Christopher L. Bennett has done with Tower of Babel and that little ending, little unexpected coda there, as we called it when we talked about the book on Literary Treks.
Well, and it would have been cool either to come across another station or to come across either a ship or something, and then they notice and they start to realize that the technology is the same. They're like, we've seen this technology. Like, it's not just the same station, because then you instantly recognize it. You turn around and you go the other way. But if it's like a cruiser or a colony and you're like, wait, this seems familiar. And then again, you're honoring those fans who watch the show and they're like, oh my gosh, this is the replicating station people. Don't trust them. They're, you know, evil. And, you know, then you learn there's, I don't know, you learn more of the plot, but I think that would be a great way to reveal that.
Definitely. Well, Darren, thanks for picking this episode today. It was a really fun discussion. And thanks for joining me here on Warp 5. And now go talk to Philip about that mug that I need with the logo, the Earl Grey logo on it.
Oh, I will, definitely. Yours, I will even make it, you know, flared out at the bottom, like, you know, a 10 forward mug. I mean, because that's the best way to go.
All right. That sounds good. All right. Well, before I let you go, tell everyone where they can find you around the network and around the interwebs.
Oh, around the network, you can find me on our regular show, which is Earl Grey, which is our next-gen series-focused show with my two co-hosts, Philip and Daniel, who you've heard recently here on Warp 5. And we just love talking about all things next-gen, from the show to the crew, episode reviews. But we really get in, you know, beyond that to a lot of the detail and the character interactions and all the great parts. And we're have our sights set on 100 episodes at least. We're blowing through it. We're never going to stop us. We're going to catch up to some of those other shows and surpass them. We're going to lap them. But so you can find me there. You can also find me on my personal sci-fi show, which is called The Dr. Sci-Fi Show. And I talk more about broad science fiction topics and change those topics each month. We just finished a topic on toys, and I did a great episode on Playmates toys, the Star Trek line, which was a lot of fun to talk about. It just one of the big things from my childhood. And this next month we'll be covering space, and I actually get to visit the Armstrong Space Research Center next month, and I'm going to do some live broadcasting from there. So I'm really excited about that. So
cool.
So podcast wise, you can find me there, or if you want to chat more about any episode of Enterprise, it's always fun to talk about. You can find me on Twitter under Dr. Sci-Fi, which is DrSciFi.
Excellent. It's too bad Playmates didn't make one of these repair station toys.
That would have been great. Or even great just, or make one that could fit around like a micro machine. So it's, you know, maybe only about 8 to 10 inches big, but you could reconfigure it.
You know, I just...
I would buy it.
You know, I just finally, these official Starship collection that Eagle Moss is doing
in
Europe and in the
US. That my budget just cannot support.
Finally came to Japan last weekend for pre-order. It's going to be available in May here. I pre-ordered. And they should do the station as part of that collection, because eventually they're going to run out of ships to do. So they need to do the station. It'll probably be like number 147 or something like that.
Well, yeah, it has to have a 47 in there because, you know, right, it's Star Trek. But that would be great. I especially if they could put a little extra into it and make it articulate where you could, you know, cat cradle or whatever that's called, make it bigger or smaller to fit around your other ships. That would be really cool.
All right. Well, thanks again for joining me, Darren.
You're welcome.
Well, it was great having Darren with me today, and I hope everyone enjoyed the discussion of Dead Stop. But this isn't the only thing we've been talking about here on the network this past week. So here's a quick look at some other things you may have missed elsewhere on Trek FM.
Previously on Trek.fm, Standard Orbit.
Dr. McCoy with Larry Nemetschek.
But, you know, when everybody else had their Kirk shirt or their Spock shirt, like the first uniform I had my mom make me was a McCoy uniform, of course.
Earl Grey.
The 7-7 Challenge.
Did you know that Tim Russ was one of the possible choices for Commander Geordi LaForge?
But did you know he was also in Star Trek Generations?
But did you know he was also served with Captain Sulu on board the Excelsior?
I did know that, in fact. The Orb.
Our Man Bashir Commentary.
I love Avery. Tell me what happens next.
And the look up at an angle. He's not even looking at Bashir. He's looking up at the angle. Tell me what happens next.
The Ready Room.
Spectre of the Gun.
They're so quick to jump to conclusions. Like, the guy gets shot in front of them and they're like, death is the only thing that's real on this planet. And like, wait a minute, how do you know that? That could just be a total figment of your imagination as well.
To the journey!
Favorite son commentary.
Yeah, Janeway is... you better get more coffee, sweetie. It's going to be a long day. Ensign Kim is going to put you through some hell.
Warp 5.
Alternate outcomes of the Zindi crisis.
But the Enterprise is heavily damaged. We're talking... practically destroyed. Everything but a shell. Maybe the saucer section is the only thing that's still around. And 80% of the crew dies. Commentary, Trek stars.
Rick Berman and Star Trek.
He's kind of a moving target, so he found some dimensionality. He made it into a cube.
Yeah.
And so he was able to move things around in there.
A Borg cube.
Continuing mission.
Star Trek Equinox.
John Savage actually came up with the premise for the story, but they needed somebody to flesh it out, to develop it. And so they sent me John's premise, and I just, well, it expanded into the script for the project that we're doing.
Melodic Treks.
The Borg in Music.
In when they released it as a Blu-ray,
and they combined them.
They connected them, and there's the no feature. Delay. They cut off that music, and then it's just like, oh, that didn't work.
Literary Treks.
Rise of the Federation, Tower of Babel.
Saval talks about this idea that, you know, people mutually consent to abide by these rules for their collective benefit. The idea that, you know, absolute unfettered freedom is just a ridiculous idea.
And that's what else is happening on Trek.fm.
So check out all of these shows and get in on our daily Trek Talk. We have new Trek Talk for you every day of the week. And some days we even have two shows for you. And you'll find them in a wide variety of places, including iTunes, Stitcher, TuneIn, Windows Phone, Xbox, Zune, or you can download or stream from our website. So go find out what we're talking about in your favorite corner of the Star Trek universe. And if you're over in iTunes, be sure to visit our new home in the iTunes store, where you'll find our dedicated artist page and section, where we're now able to group and highlight our shows and our past content to make it easier for you to find things that maybe you haven't heard before. We're quickly approaching 1,000 episodes here on Trek FM, so there's a wealth of interviews and discussion waiting for you there, and the quickest way to get to it all is to simply go to itunes.com/trekfm. And while you're over there, if you enjoy the show, leave us a star rating and a written review. We do love to hear from you, and it also helps other Enterprise fans find Warp 5 as they're looking for content in the iTunes store. If you'd like to share your thoughts with us on Dead Stop or anything Enterprise or Star Trek for that matter, you can do that in a variety of ways. You can go to our website at trek.fm/contact to send us a message. There's a form there. Choose to send to a show and choose Warp 5, and that will come to me by email. You can also leave us a voicemail through the website, or you can go to our forums at trek.fm/forums to talk to us and other listeners about Warp 5, Enterprise, or anything about Star Trek that you'd like to discuss. And if you'd like to find me, you can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. You can find me pretty much anywhere in social media under that same username, as well as on my personal website at cbrianjones.com. And then elsewhere on the network, you'll find me on quite a few shows. I do Literary Treks with Matthew Rushing, where we talk Star Trek books and comics, and we interview authors. Matthew and I also do The Orb together, which is a lot like this show, except it's about Deep Space Nine. You'll find me on Matter Stream, which is about science and social issues and creative things that are inspired by Star Trek, not necessarily about Star Trek itself. And there I have interviews with scientists and actors and other creatives and all sorts of people there. And you'll also find me on Continuing Mission, which is about Star Trek fan films and independent productions. And we're going to be getting into some games there pretty soon as well. And then you'll find me every week with other hosts from all around the network, including Darren from time to time, on The Ready Room, where we talk about Star Trek news and all five live-action Star Trek series. So check out those shows as well. Before I let you go, I'd like to tell you about our sponsor for today's show, Audible.com. They are the best source for audiobooks that you'll find anywhere. They have over 150,000 titles waiting for you right now, and they add hundreds of new titles every single week. They have new releases, bestsellers, classics, lots of Star Trek books as well, like Prime Directive, Federation, and Spock's World, which are three of my favorites. And as a Trek FM listener, you can get a free audiobook of your choice along with a trial to see just how great Audible is. So go over to audibletrial.com/trekfm and sign up today. Choose any book you like, absolutely free. And there's nothing to lose, because if at the end of the trial you decide that you don't want to stick with Audible, you get to keep that book. But, you know, if you like podcasts, I know you're going to love Audible. So give it a try. audibletrial.com/trekfm. And your support of Audible helps us keep Warp 5 coming to you every week. And we really thank Audible for their support of the show and the network. We'd also like to invite you to check out Andrew Allen's Smooth Federation. That's where you'll find this smooth jazz cover of Where My Heart Will Take Me that we use here on the show. Andrew also has 9 other jazz renditions of music from across the Star Trek universe, so go pick it up today. I know you're going to love it. I love it, listen to it all the time, and you'll find it in iTunes or on Amazon. Really great stuff there by Andrew. Well, thanks for listening, everyone, today. Again, I hope you enjoyed the show. I hope you'll send us some feedback. We'd love to hear from you. And join us again next week here in the Decon Chamber for another episode of Warp 5.